had mingled with rainwater, forming a thick black sludge on the marble floor. Amid the wreckage stood the fossilized form of a man, an enduring reminder of Nodon's treachery. The cruel Magus had used his dark magic to turn Lot Ionan the Forbearing to stone. Wenceslas stepped over the fallen columns and followed Andakai to the center of the chamber, where the floor was littered with splintered malachite. "I'm going to send a charm in your direction. Only a weak one, so you won't come to any harm, but enough to gauge your aptitude for magic." She signaled for Namora to position herself behind him and catch him if he fell. "Ready?" Without waiting for an answer, she hurled a glowing blue sphere toward Wenceslas, who raised his arms unthinkingly, palms outstretched to stop the missile. The spluttering sphere hit his hands and sent him flying backwards. There was a hissing noise, and he yelped in pain and shock. Namora was behind him straight away, holding him by the armpits to save him from the splinters on the floor. But the glowing sphere continued on its path. Whizzing through the air, it spiraled higher and higher, gathering speed for its next attack. Like an angry wasp, it circled above them, then swooped toward Wenceslas. "Mega!" gasped Namora, alarmed. When no help was forthcoming, she laid Wenceslas gently on the floor and prepared to face the magic weapon. Using a wooden plank as a shield, she took up position and watched as the sphere zigzagged crazily toward her. It came within half a forearm of her, then it burst. Andakai's eyebrows shot up in surprise. "Congratulations, Wenceslas," she praised him. "I believe in challenging my pupils, it brings out their talent." She walked over and examined his scorched palms. "Don't worry about your hands. The skin will soon heal." Groaning, Wenceslas clambered to his feet.
"Estimable Mega, it's no use pretending that I passed," he said dejectedly. "We both know that I didn't stop the sphere. It's nice of you to be encouraging, but I'm not a magician. If you hadn't taken pity on me, I would have been killed." He picked up his bag. "Turga told me that I wasn't cut out to be a Famulus, and he was right. If only I could... Oh, what's the use?"
Sighing, he bowed before the Maga and took his leave.
"May the gods be with you."
They heard his footsteps echoing through the arcades. Then Jeroen set off after him to escort him through the gates. The Maga studied Namora's face.
"So it was you," she murmured incredulously. "You destroyed the sphere."
Her eyes narrowed dangerously.
"How? You told me you inherited a few tricks from your mother, nothing more. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Alfar can't do magic."
Namora seemed as surprised as she was.
I didn't use a spell or anything. I just wanted the sphere to go away. I was thinking about it disappearing, and then..."
She tailed off and raised a hand to her eyes.
"It disappeared? Just like that?" she whispered.
She seemed almost scared. Andakai was the first to recover her composure.
"Do you know what this means, Namora?" she said excitedly, laying her hands on the half-elf's shoulders. "I've found my apprentice. It won't take long before you're ready to..."
"No!" Namora's refusal was spoken with such intensity and conviction that Andakai let go and took a step back.
"No?"
she said uncomprehendingly, searching Namora's face for signs that she might be swayed.
"You can't mean that."
Namora drew herself up to her full height.
"Yes, I can."
She wasn't afraid of Andakai's wrath. "I'm sure there are better candidates, and I'm willing to help you find them. But I won't be your Famulus." She met the Maga's questioning stare.
"Remember what happened at the Black Saddle? It's a wonder that we survived. No more adventures. That's what we decided. And I've given Fergus my word. We came to Parista so that Fergus could help you rebuild the city. And I'm here because of him. Nothing is going to separate us again.
She paused, noticing the Maga's baffled expression.
It doesn't make sense to you, I suppose.
She sat down on a fallen column and lowered her voice.
Listen, Andikai. I want to grow old with Fergus. I want to have children and grandchildren. And I want to see them grow up. How am I supposed to do that if I train to be a Maga? I don't want to risk my life for Gurdlegaard. I love Fergus, and I'm happy the way I am.
She lifted her loose-fitting breastplate. Her figure was fuller than usual.
I'm going to be a mother, she said, stroking her bump. The baby is due in 90 orbits.
Andikai snorted angrily and made no reply. The news hadn't produced the intended effect.
Nomura took a deep breath. Excuse me, Maga. It's getting late. It's time I went home to Fergus.
She got up and walked to the door.
Is there anything I can say to persuade you?
The Maga called after her, undaunted.
How can I change your mind?
Nomura glanced over her shoulder and saw Andikai silhouetted in the light of the rising moon.
I don't intend to break my promise, she said firmly as she made her way out.
Sighing, the Maga went over to the statue of Lot Ionan, formerly a man of flesh and blood.
My poor friend. I could do with your support, she whispered absently.
Her fingers stroked the smooth marble, tracing the folds of his cloak. The Magus of Ionandar was dead. Dead like Turgar the Fair-Faced, Sabora the Softly Spoken, and Myra the Life Preserver. She turned around sadly, surveying the wreckage of the hall. Nomura was a fool to sacrifice her talents for love of a man. Richmark, southeastern Goregar, Gurdlegaard, spring, 6235th solar cycle. King Bruron stood at the gates and watched as a steady stream of loaded wagons left the storehouse. His entourage was made up of 7 bodyguards and 2 stewards, whose job was to write down how many drums of grain were heading north. The first wagon had left the capital at dawn, on course for the far reaches of the kingdom, where the soil had been blighted by the perished land. The fields and meadows were beginning to recover, and by summer they would be fertile. But there was nothing for the farmers to sow. They desperately needed seeds, not to mention food to see them through.
"Supplies are dangerously low, Your Majesty," said the first steward,
noting another figure on his wax tablet. He pointed the stylus at the convoy of wagons.
"The silos are almost empty," replied the king,
dressed inconspicuously in dark brown cloth, as if he were an ordinary stocktaker. He watched for a moment as the last of his provisions left the capital for the provinces, the drums of grain jiggling up and down in the wagons.
"I've taken the necessary measures. Yesterday, King Nate received payment for 5,000 drums of grain to be delivered to the northern provinces. Ido Slane will supply the rest."
He smiled and thumped the steward on the back.
"I've been keeping count as well. None of my subjects will go hungry. Another 5,000 drums are on the way."
His bodyguard alerted him to a group of riders who seemed intent on cantering through the gates of the storehouse. There were 30 in total, 3 dwarves and the rest men, and their grim faces left little doubt as to their mood. Bruron's smile vanished from his lips. The arrival of the delegation wasn't entirely unexpected, but it filled him with dread. It was too late to slip away unnoticed, so he would have to face his troublesome guests. The first rider reined in his horse. No sooner was he out of the saddle than a group of servants surrounded the horse and led it away. His soldiers stayed mounted, but the 3 dwarves lined up beside the man.
"Greetings, King Bruron,"
said the ruler of Idoslane with a cursory bow.
"Welcome to Richmark, Prince Malin,"
the king replied warmly.
I was heartened to hear of your victory against the orcs.
He turned to the dwarves and smiled.
Please extend my thanks to your commanders. The people of Goragar won't forget how the allied army saved them from the green-hided beasts. They are very grateful.
He laid a bejeweled hand on his chest, as am I. One of the dwarves thumped the ground with the pole of his axe.
Yet you handed the black saddle to our enemies while we were fighting on your behalf. Is that how you show gratitude? I call it disloyal and underhanded, and I don't mind telling you that. I expected better from a human king.
Bruron looked pained.
Those are harsh accusations, Master Dwarf. Especially as I had no choice. I agreed to take over the watch when your kinsfolk left the Black Saddle, but I had no way of knowing that a centuries-old agreement would force me to...
Betray your allies, the dwarf finished for him,
the creases on his forehead deepening into furrows. Prince Malin studied the wagons of grain.
An agreement, you say?
Many cycles ago, the House of Goragar signed a treaty with Lorimber's folk, according to which the Black Saddle was ceded to the Thirdlings, for perpetuity, and with no recourse.
Are you sure the document is genuine?
Asked Malin.
Bruron inclined his grey head.
I'm afraid so. My archivist scoured our deepest vaults and highest towers, and the evidence confirms the terms of the agreement. The Thirdlings helped my forebears to mine Cloudpiercer's riches, and the Black Saddle was their reward.
He turned to the dwarfs.
The stronghold belongs to the Thirdlings, he said apologetically. What was I supposed to do? Refuse? Suggested one of the dwarves. My forefathers signed a treaty with the Thirdlings, and it behooves me to uphold its terms. Surely the dwarves, with their fondness for tradition, can understand the situation.
His tone had undergone a sudden change, becoming sharper and more impatient. It was obvious that he considered the matter closed.
The Black Saddle belongs to the Thirdlings. I'm not thrilled about it either, but the honor of Goragar is at stake.
Malin looked at him squarely.
I won't presume to judge you, Bruron, but in your position, I would have advised my allies of the treaty and looked for a better solution. I didn't have the luxury of...
You could have requested more time, a few extra orbits to check the treaty's terms, cut in Malin.
Instead, you allowed the dwarf killers to seize a stronghold that poses a strategic threat to our friends. We'll soon find out how Lorimbas intends to use his advantage.
He locked gazes with the monarch, smiling coolly as the other looked away. It was obvious that Bruron had been offered some inducement to remind him of the treaty's terms.
I see what this is about, he whispered in the king's ear. You have no idea, hissed Bruron. My subjects are starving. Grain costs money, and I'm spending a fortune to keep them alive. If my allies would waive the cost of the...
It's rude to whisper, boomed one of the dwarves. We won't inconvenience you any longer. We're needed in Jon Balsur. But don't worry, King Bruron. We'll be sure to tell our kinsfolk what you said. No doubt the High King will reach his own conclusions about your obligations.
The three dwarves raised their hands and took their leave with a gesture that could have passed for an obscenity or a wave.
So you sold it, said Malin angrily as soon as they were out of earshot. You traded the Black Saddle for gold. No, snapped Bruron. My forebears signed a treaty. I kept to the terms. And risked the wrath of the dwarves? What if they cut their ties with the human kingdoms?
Malin shook his head bitterly.
I said before that I wouldn't judge you, but I've changed my mind. You're a fool for ceding the Black Saddle to the Thirdlings.
The king turned on him angrily.
How dare you? I speak only the truth, broke in Malin,
weary of Bruron's excuses.
Even a king must be censured if he errs. Don't you realize what's happening in Jon Balsur? The dwarves lost 300 warriors in a night. They were murdered in their sleep, duped by Alfar,
who claimed to be envoys for Lutacil. And now, a strategically crucial stronghold, complete with weaponry and supplies, is in the hands of the dwarf killers. How do you think our friends will react?
Bruron's self-assurance vanished.
I hadn't heard, he said, concerned. I'll tell my advisers to find a way of annulling the treaty.
You do that, King Bruron. New friendships are easily sundered. The dwarves are valuable allies. We can't afford to lose them.
He paused, deciding that he had said enough.
By the way, I came to tell you that we've started setting fire to the forests around John Balsur. The trees are harder to burn than we thought, and we'll need more pitch. But it's working. The assault on the Alfar's Black Kingdom will soon begin.
I have news for you as well, Prince Malin, said the king.
He hesitated.
The Thirdlings want to speak with you. Their spokesman is in the capital, waiting for you to send word.
He gave Malin the name of a boarding house.
I've met a few groundlings in my time, but these ones are...
He checked himself and tried to mask his disquiet.
In any case, you're more experienced at handling them than me.
Malin swung himself onto his horse.
I've nothing to say to the Thirdlings. We're leaving this very orbit. A couple of orcish commanders are limping back to Toboribor, and I intend to destroy their troops.
He raised his hand in farewell.
Palandriel be with you and your men, said Bruron sincerely.
May the alliance hold strong, replied Malin.
At his command, the cavalrymen formed a guard around him, and they left the storeroom in the direction they had come. The king of Goregar lowered his yellow-flecked eyes and examined the lists that his stewards had prepared. After a moment's consideration, he reached a decision. For the good of his kingdom. The 3 cases of gold that would arrive in the capital in 9 orbits' time would allow him to purchase further supplies. There was no point in throwing the Thirdlings out of the Black Saddle until he had accumulated enough gold to secure his kingdom's future. Bruron was certain that Malin and the dwarves would think differently if they knew the suffering of his people. No other kingdom was ravaged as badly as Goregar.
After orbits of eating mouldering wheat, my subjects shall have fresh bread. Happier times are ahead for my kingdom.
See to it that the silos are emptied, he told his stewards. Tell the farmers in the northern provinces to till every inch of fertile land, and order another 9,000 drums of barley from Tabane. I won't have my subjects eating crumbs.
I'm sorry I wasn't in when you called.
The deep voice sounded from near Malin's feet. The prince, unaccustomed to being addressed in such an irreverent manner, stopped admiring the red-tinged clouds above Richmark and looked down to identify the speaker. It was a heavily armed dwarf who had slipped past his guards.
I didn't call, he said coldly. There was nothing to discuss.
He raised a hand to reassure his guards, fearing that any action on their part would result in bloodshed. The dwarf's armor was unlike anything that Malin had seen. His reinforced spaulders were fitted with finger-length spikes, sharp blades glistened on his vambraces, and his gauntlets boasted sharp metal studs. Even without drawing his weapons, he could wound or kill a man.
If you don't have a name, said Malin, I'd be happy to choose one for you, although it might not meet with your approval.
In which case, I'd knock you out of the saddle, and I'm loath to hurt your splendid horse.
The dwarf smiled unpleasantly, the black tattoos on his cheeks rearranging themselves briefly.
If you care for your mount, you'd do well to call me Romo. Romo Steelheart of the Clan of the Stonegrinders, descendant of Lorim Burr, and nephew of King Lorim Bass. I'm here on my uncle's business.
Malin's gaze travelled over the dwarf, taking in his breastplate, the steel plates protecting his thighs, and the three-chained Morning Star on his belt.
You're dressed for war, not business. With a tongue like yours, you're bound to find enemies, I suppose.
My enemies are your allies, and our war has been raging since the creation of the dwarves.
He reached down and pulled a sealed leather roll from his boot.
From my uncle. He told me to bring him your reply.
He held out the roll for Malin to take. It seemed to the prince that he should read the missive. If nothing else, it would apprise him of the Thirdling's intentions. He broke the seal, opened the roll, and pulled out the parchment. He was expecting some form of blackmail, which was exactly what the letter contained. It referred to an ancient treaty between the House of Ido and the Thirdlings, in which the latter agreed to provide assistance in combating Toboribor's orcs. The arrangement still stood. Idoslain's defences depended on the dwarves' undying hatred of orcs. Dwarven warriors, renowned for their toughness, staffed the outposts in parts of the kingdom most vulnerable to the marauding hordes. But it was difficult to know which of them were Thirdlings because, unlike Romo, they looked no different to ordinary dwarves. According to the letter, the Thirdling's services were conditional on Malin sticking to the terms of an agreement signed by his forefathers. It was the first he had heard of such a deal.
"I'm afraid your king is mistaken," he said firmly,
lowering the parchment.
"Tell him I don't like his scheming. First he seizes the Black Saddle, then he tries to turn Idoslain against her allies. Nothing can induce me to pick a fight with the Fourthlings."
He dropped the letter, watching as it floated toward a pile of horse dung.
"King Gandergar is more than an ally. He's a friend."
"How touching," scoffed Romo,
seemingly unsurprised by his refusal.
"Perhaps my uncle can take his place in your affections. We demand that you keep to the terms of the agreement. Your forebears signed the treaty of their own free will."
"I won't be held to ransom by your uncle. My forefathers weren't allied to the Fourthlings, and their adherence to the treaty was never tested. In fact, I can't recall any reference to an agreement with the Thirdlings. It wouldn't surprise me if the document were a fake."
He leaned forward in his saddle.
"Tell King Lorimbas that bribery worked on Bruron, but it won't work on me. He can keep his gold."
"We didn't bribe Bruron. We paid him."
Romo poked the letter with his boot, watching as the parchment sank into the brown, soggy dung.
"You must be very proud of your kingdom, Prince Malin. I suppose your cavalry is strong enough to deal with the orcs, provided you've got enough mercenaries watching your borders."
"Is that a threat?"
"A threat?" echoed Romo, feigning surprise. "My uncle merely said to tell you."
Malin didn't wait to hear the rest. Dropping the leather holder into the mud, he kicked his heels into the horse's flanks and rode away. He had said everything he wanted to say. The cavalrymen, noticing their monarch's displeasure, took their leave from the dwarf without ceremony. Their places were taken by the traders and citizens of Richmark, who trampled the dung-soaked parchment underfoot. Romo watched Malin's departure with a contemptuous grunt.
"He'll see the consequences of his obstinacy soon enough."
The dwarf was pleased that the passers-by were careful not to crowd him. They were nervous of dwarfs, and his demeanour did nothing to calm their fears. Malin's refusal to ally himself with the Thirdlings meant that Romo was obliged to continue his journey in a northeasterly direction. He could be sure that his advances would be looked on more sympathetically there. A group of children ventured closer, stopping a few paces away and staring at him with open curiosity.
"Are you a dwarf as well?" asked the eldest among them. "Why do you look so funny?"
"For the same reason you look so ugly," he growled.
Then he realized the implications of the child's words.
"Of course, I am a dwarf, a very special dwarf, a warrior, if you must know.
He smiled a crooked smile.
Are more of my kind in town?
The children jumped up and down, nodding eagerly.
What a wonderful coincidence. Can you tell me where I might find them?
He took a coin from his leather purse and threw it to the tallest boy. His right hand closed around the metal haft of his morning star. He intended to end his business in Richmark on a high. Chapter 4 Southern Entrance to the Fifthling Kingdom, Girdlegard, Spring, 6235th Solar Cycle.
It hasn't changed since last time, said Boindil,
gazing at the crumbling ramparts and fallen towers that were all that remained of the stronghold's glory. He, Tungdil, Belindus, and a group of 20 hand-picked warriors were marching ahead to survey the land. The gateway to the Fifthling Kingdom lay before them, tall as a house and tantalizingly close. The doors had been smashed to pieces. Boindil looked back at the steep path leading down the mountainside. The remaining dwarves were about a mile away, working their way to the top with their belongings and supplies.
They're moving too fast, he muttered. They need to be more careful with Boindil's stretcher, and they shouldn't be making so much noise.
He dispatched a warrior to pass on the message. Tungdil left the little group, ducked behind the weathered ruins, and darted toward the gateway, moving as quietly as he could. Mindful of the possible dangers, he had taken his axe from his belt and was ready to strike at a moment's notice. A few paces from the gateway, he stopped and crouched behind a pile of rubble.
Hey, that wasn't the deal, growled Ironheart, setting off after him. What are you playing at, scholar? The first 10 orcs belong to me.
He ducked down, charging from rock to rock, and sheltering behind the ruined ramparts, now almost fully visible beneath the melting snow. Belindus and the others ran after him, rattling and clunking like an army of tinkers. Tungdil rolled his eyes.
You couldn't be more obvious if you were singing dwarven war songs, he hissed irritably. Have a good mind to make you take off your chainmail.
He focused his attention on the dark gateway leading into the mountain. Everything was still. The silence was broken by dripping water. All around them stalactites were melting, and not far from the gateway, a waterfall free at last from its icy prison was cascading down the slope. Spray rose into the air, lingering in a haze of iridescent mist.
I sooner shave off my beard than take off my chainmail, protested Boindil. I'm naked without it.
He flared his nostrils, sniffing the air for orcs.
Not a whiff of them. Oh, their rancid armor.
He turned to Tungdil and Belindus.
Remember the orcs in the smelting works?
His eyes lit up with the memory.
They were packed in so tightly, just waiting to be killed. I couldn't swing my axe without disemboweling a dozen of them by accident. Do you think... Quiet! Ordered Tungdil,
conscious that Belindus was looking at him. She had been true to her word and joined the expedition, not as his fiancée, but as a friend. At her side was Glaimbar Sharpaxe, to whom she would soon be melded. Tungdil didn't know how to behave around her. In the space of an orbit, he had gone from being a lover to a friend, but his tortured heart refused to accept the change.
I'll go first, he said.
Stooping low, he darted off and stopped to the side of the gateway, pressing his ear to the wall and listening for sounds from within. Hearing nothing, he slipped inside and disappeared into the gloom. Boindil jiggled his axes impatiently.
I can't stand it, he spluttered.
His inner furnace was overheating, stoked by his fiery spirit and concern for his brother's life.
We should be seizing the dragonfire furnace and making my brother well. I'm going straight to the Fifthling smithy, and no one can stop me. Not you or 100 orcs.
Throwing caution to the wind, he jumped up and ran through the gateway. Belindis, swearing softly, hurried after him, followed by the others. The tread of their boots on the rock sounded different in the tunnel. Belindis found herself imagining that she was running across the roof of a cavern, but she pushed the thought aside. A moment later, she and the others almost barreled into Tungdil, who had come to a halt at the end of the tunnel.
"Forget what I said about keeping down the noise," he said testily.
"They're bound to have heard us by now."
He gripped Keenfire with both hands.
"It's time to find out whether Teon's beasts are still squatting in our stronghold, or whether they found themselves another home."
"That's more like it," said Boindil cheerily. "Dwarves don't hold with sneaking and skulking. It's cowardly and underhanded."
He flashed them a ferocious grin.
"Show me where the runts are hiding. I'm dying for a fight."
"How unusual,"
said Belindis, cross with him for breaking rank. They set off through the passageways, Tungdil, Belindis, and Boindil, who knew the stronghold from their previous visit, leading the way. The likenesses of dead fifthling chieftains greeted them, axes hefted from gleaming palladium panels on the walls. They soon found evidence of orcish activity, a trail of dirt and muddy prints, some booted, others unshod, leading toward the exit. It seemed the beasts had marched through the stronghold on their way to the Black Saddle. On reaching a many-columned, pentagonal chamber, they took the passageway to the Dragonfire Furnace. Tungdil's memories came flooding back. He heard Gandagar's booming voice taunting Nodon's hordes. He saw images of his dead friends, and he braced himself for grunting orcs and squawking Bognilim. But the halls were deathly still.
"Botheration! It's empty as an ogre's skull," cursed Boindil, as they reached the smelting works adjoining the furnace. The fires had gone out beneath the blast furnaces. The chamber was cold, and the air stank of excrement and orc.
"They've abandoned the halls," said Boindil, striding toward the door.
"What are you waiting for? To the dragon fire furnace! What's the betting it's still alight?"
Tungdil realized it was useless to reprimand his reckless friend. Consumed with worry about his brother, Boindil was at the mercy of his temper. Finding some orcs would give him an outlet for his anger and stop him harming the rest of the group. Boindil was driven by hatred for Teon's creation, which made him a fearsome warrior, and a danger to others and himself. Unless he vented his rage, the flames of his furnace would burn higher and higher until he threw himself on whoever had the misfortune to be in his way. His fiery nature was a blessing and a curse. They entered the Dragonfire Furnace and immediately noticed a change in temperature. 20 hearths and 80 anvils were arranged around the central furnace. The vast room was filled with an odor so foul that the dwarves, covering their noses, tried not to gag. Decaying corpses lay strewn across the floor. Orcs, Bognilim, a handful of Alfar, and even 3 trolls. This was the work of Bavragor Hammersmith, and the undead fifthlings who had given their lives so that Tungdil and the others could escape.
"By the beard of Berowyn, what a battle it must have been," murmured Boindil respectfully. "I never thought the merry minstrel had it in him."
They sifted through the bodies, hoping to give a proper burial to their friends, but nothing remained except chainmail and cloth. The valiant warriors had been overpowered and torn to pieces.
"Look," said Belindis, pointing her axe at the main furnace. "It's still burning."
Tungdil breathed out in relief. With Dragonfire, his worries about forging weaponry, armor, and other equipment for the kingdom were instantly solved.
"Fan the flames! Giselbert's kingdom belongs to the dwarves!"
The dwarves shoveled coal onto the furnace, taking care not to extinguish the flickering flames. Then they pulled on the chains connected to the giant bellows and breathed new life into Dragonfire's heart. Tungdil sent Boindil and 9 others to relay the good news to the rest of the company and guide them through the passageways. In the meantime, Belindis set about opening the vents to the flue. The fifthlings had sabotaged the mechanism to stop the orcs following Tungdil and the others through the chimney. She looked up at the ceiling, 80 paces above. A stone staircase led to the flue, which was blocked by a pair of solid metal plates.
"I'll need a bit of time, but I can fix it," she said,
raising her voice so that Tungdil, who was standing nearby, would have to respond.
"The chain came down because they destroyed the main sprocket. I'll have the mechanism working in less than an orbit."
Tungdil nodded, but didn't turn round.
"It shouldn't take long to clear up the forge. The bodies can go in the furnace. We'll find a use for the melted armor."
He bent down and discovered tongs, hammers, chisels, files, and other tools hidden beneath the rotting remains.
"We'll soon have the smithy ringing with the sound of our hammers. The Fifthling Kingdom has been waiting for hundreds of cycles to hear the music of the forge."
Glancing round to check no one was watching, Belindis strode over to Tungdil and grabbed him by the arm.
"Tungdil, Goldhand, what did I do to deserve this?" she demanded, her brown eyes smouldering as fiercely as the furnace.
"I don't know what you mean," he said, scanning the hall intently as if he were planning the details of the clean-up operation.
Belindis's powerful fingers, accustomed to toiling at the anvil, refused to let him go.
"Are you ignoring me as a punishment? You shouldn't treat me this way. I'm your friend."
"My friend?"
erupted Tungdil.
"We were in love, Belindis. We wanted to be joined by the Iron Band. And then you decided to pledge yourself to a stranger just because he's a sharp scythe or a blunt taxa or whatever."
He broke off and looked at her hopefully. "You haven't finished with him, have you?" She closed her eyes.
"No, Tungdil, it's the law. I have to obey my clan."
"Even at the cost of your happiness?"
"My happiness," he corrected himself.
"Yes," she said simply. "There's nothing more sacred. Nothing we prize more highly than tradition. Tradition has kept our society together for thousands of cycles. It allows us to live in harmony. It keeps our clans alive. Sometimes it means we have to make sacrifices. But it's all for the greater good. You'll understand when you've lived in a dwarfing kingdom for a while. At least I hope you will."
She let go of his arm and went to stroke his cheek, but he jerked away.
"Don't do this to me," he said bitterly. "You're making it worse."
Too choked to talk, he turned away and hurried out of the forge, where he bumped into Boindil, who was leading the procession to the furnace. The 4 dwarves, carrying his frozen brother, were just behind. Glad of anything that might distract him from his thoughts, Tungdil set about sorting the dwarves into groups and sending them into the passageways to scour the stronghold for hidden orcs. Over the course of the journey, Boendal's stretcher had been strapped to a pony or, when the terrain was uneven, carried by his fellow dwarves. They walked the stretcher to the middle of the room and set it down by the furnace. The flames were becoming brighter and fiercer all the time.
"What now?"
inquired Boindil, eyeing his brother's pale face.
"Do you think he'll wake up?"
Tungdil laid a hand on Boendal's brow. It felt cold and dry.
"No change yet, but the furnace isn't up to temperature. We'll wait a bit longer for the pure white flames."
"And then what?"
demanded Boindil. He reached for his brother's hand and clasped it tight.
"We could fill a tankard with glowing coal, add some beer, and pour it down his throat," he said hopefully.
Tungdil shook his head.
"I can't make sense of the riddle, but I promise you this. We'll ransack the Fifthling's archives until we find a solution."
He got up and signalled for the physicians to attend to Boendal.
"Come on,"
he said, thumping Boindil's broad back.
There's work to be done.
The two dwarves left the forge, leaving Belindis to stare after them, sadly. The following orbits saw the peaceful takeover of the kingdom continue apace. The secondling masons lost no time in beginning the restoration work on the badly damaged chambers and corridors, with everyone lending a hand when it came to transporting the stone. The firstling smiths fired up the blast furnaces and forged metal strips and bands to reinforce the gateways and doors. Their constant hammering echoed through the underground halls, reminding the mountain of the activity within it 6,000 cycles before. In the early stages of the project, there wasn't any call for diamond cutting or gem polishing, so the fourthlings helped wherever they were needed and set about exploring every passageway, chamber, nook, and cranny of the kingdom. But no matter how hard they searched, there was still no sign of a tablet or document containing the key to Dragonfire's power. And so the orbits passed, and Boendal continued to lie by the fire, his inner furnace cold and weak. Tungdil and the others were barely aware of the passing time. New treasures were discovered every orbit, and the fifthling's craftsmanship became a source of continual delight. The firstlings, who had hitherto considered themselves experts in the art of working gold and other precious metals, readily admitted that the smiths of Giselbert possessed skills in excess of their own. After orbits of searching, Tungdil decided that nothing in the halls and chambers would help them to revive the frozen dwarf. He gathered an advance party of warriors and set off in the direction of the stone gateway, hoping to find something there. If he were honest, it was also a way of escaping Belindis, who was torturing him with her beautiful smile, her lovable manner, and her irresistible curves. The idea of Belindis living side by side with Glaimbar Sharpaxe, her iron-beating kinsman, was enough to make his spirit plummet deeper than the darkest mine. Worse still, it encouraged his thoughts in untoward directions, and he found himself wishing that Glaimbar would die. He allowed his mind to ponder the prospect. "His death would solve everything, wouldn't it?" said a voice in his ear. "If Belindis were widowed, no one would object to her taking a suitor, whoever he was." Tungdil bristled. If Belindis took a new suitor, it would obviously be him. "Everyone would be happier," whispered the demon inside his head. Tungdil, shocked at himself, banished the voice. He was so withdrawn and miserable that Boindil, who had insisted on joining the expedition, couldn't help but notice.
"I suppose there's a downside to being a dwarf," commented the secondling when they stopped to rest their legs.
They were sitting on the rocky banks of an underground stream, far enough away from the band of 50 dwarves for their conversation to go unheard. It gave Boindil the courage to speak freely.
"I know, scholar," he said, puffing vigorously on his pipe until the tobacco caught light. "I don't have a knack with words, but I can listen. It doesn't take much brains."
He crossed his arms and leaned back against the rock, waiting.
"It's time we talked."
"About what?"
"Whatever is bothering you."
He prodded Tungdil's chainmail with the stem of his pipe.
"I can shout her name until you tell me," he threatened.
Sighing loudly, Tungdil cut himself a slice of dried mushroom to go with his cheese.
"It's not fair," he said succinctly.
Then his pent-up anguish came out in a torrent of words.
"I thought we could still be friends," he said finally.
"I wasn't expecting it to be so hard."
His appetite gone, he put down the mushroom and took a long draught of brandy instead.
"I'd go easy on the drinking," warned Boindil,
still puffing noisily on his pipe.
"You wouldn't be the first to drown yourself in brandy. I don't like seeing you like this, especially when me and Boendal are to blame."
"How do you figure that?" asked Tungdil,
running a hand over his beard to wipe away the drops.
"Remember all the things we talked about on the long march to Ogre's death?"
his friend said earnestly.
"You asked about our customs, but I guess we forgot the most important ones, or maybe we should have explained them better. It's all about family, clan, and folk. The laws are there to keep order, to protect us, to keep us safe. Without them, everything,
falls apart," supplied Tungdil, realizing that Boindil was struggling.
"Exactly. So Belindis didn't have a choice, do you see?
I grew up in a human realm.
Do humans choose their partners willy-nilly with no regard for their families?"
demanded Boindil.
"No,"
conceded Tungdil. "But love comes first. I thought dwarves would be the same." He leaned back against the rock next to his friend.
"Look, I've been thinking.
The fifthlings should choose a new leader."
"What for? You're the one they want. Tungdil Goldhand, hero of the Black Saddle, rightful heir to Giselbert's belt, and the only dwarf who can kindle the power of Keenfire."
"They need a dwarf who grew up with our lore. Someone who knows the traditions and respects them. There aren't many of us, and we're miles from other kingdoms. Our future depends on us pulling together. Keenfire and I will fight if we're needed. I don't have to be leader as well." Boindil removed his pipe and blew smoke rings through his mouth. He waited for the blue smoke to disperse.
"I understand what you're saying, scholar. I've never known anyone so wise," he said admiringly.
Tungdil reached into the bubbling stream and scooped a handful of water into his mouth. It was wonderfully clear, slightly metallic but delicious. It tasted 100 times better than any overland spring or river, and it slaked the thirst at once.
"Is it wrong of me to wish him dead?"
he asked softly, damping his hair with his hands.
"Who? Glaimbar Sharpaxe?" Boindil roared with laughter. "I've been wishing him dead since I met him. Anyone who makes my best friend unhappy and pilfers his girlfriend deserves as much."
On seeing Tungdil's shock, he laughed again.
"What's the matter? I'm crazy, remember? My inner furnace has melted my mind."
He made an effort to be serious.
"Honestly, Tungdil, I'd challenge Sharpaxe to a duel if I thought it would do any good. But rules are made for a reason. One rash deed leads to another, and before you know it, it's a bloodbath."
He thumped Tungdil on the knee.
"Chin up, scholar! You'll find another maiden who'll give you a place in her heart and her bed. You'll forget about Belindis."
"No,"
said Tungdil.
"It's the only way,"
his friend advised sharply.
"You can't store up your anger forever. Believe me, I know."
He handed his pipe to Tungdil, who took it gratefully. Long moments passed as they sat in silence by the stream.
"If it weren't for Glaimbar, you and Belindis would be happy," said the fiendish voice in Tungdil's head. "She'll be miserable with Glaimbar. Do her a favor and kill him when you have a chance."
"How will you do it?"
"Do what?" asked Tungdil guiltily, sure that Boindil could read his thoughts.
"Tell them you don't want to be leader. How will they know whom to choose?"
"Oh, I'll say what I said to you," he said carelessly. "They should pick a leader of proper dwarven stock."
He fell silent because Boindil was on his feet, sniffing the air excitedly. His axes flew to his hands.
"You can't say the Grey Range doesn't look after us. It gives us everything we ask for. Water for our gullets and orcs for our blades."
His eyes glinted as he grinned at Tungdil.
"Can't you smell the stinking runts?"
He pointed to a passageway on the right.
"This way, down the tunnel."
The tunnel was labelled with an ancient inscription to signpost the route. It led upward, toward the stone gateway. Their brief rest was over. Hurriedly they packed their things and lined up for battle with the warriors at the front. The masons, more accustomed to splitting granite than crushing orc skulls, brought up the rear with their chisels, hammers, and other tools. The unit of dwarves moved off down the corridor at a jog. By now, Tungdil could smell the beasts' acrid perspiration and the rancid fat on their armor. The foul odor was anathema to any dwarf.
"I knew they'd turn up sometime," said Boindil gleefully as he jogged at Tungdil's side. "Nodon or no Nodon, they can't keep away from our borders. Gerdlegard is too tempting for a band of hungry orcs."
Tungdil spotted light in the distance. They were nearing the end of the tunnel. The stone gateway, a miracle of dwarven masonry, awaited them on the surface along with an unknown number of enemy troops.
"Word won't have got out that the dwarves have recaptured the Fifthling Kingdom," said Boindil, tossing his black plate over his shoulder. "I reckon we can kill at least 100 before they catch on. We'll storm out and take them by surprise."
"You'll do no such thing," his friend told him sternly. "I want to see who we're dealing with."
He tiptoed to the end of the passageway and peered outside. 2 dozen or so orcs were standing in a huddle on the site of the ruined gateway. The portal was wide open. The 5 powerful bolts that had once protected Gerdlegard from invasion in pieces on the ground. At some point during the orcish occupation, the beasts had pried the metal from the doors. The leader of the band pointed to a flight of stairs leading up to a watchtower. They didn't seem in a particular hurry, and Tungdil had the impression they were studying the defences. As if to confirm his suspicions, one of the orcs bent down to inspect a fragment of bolt, while the rest set about climbing the stairs.
"How many are there?" asked Boindil, eagerly, banging his axes together. 100? 200? How many runts can I kill?"
Tungdil described the group.
"What? Only 2 dozen?
Spat Boindil. He gave the others a threatening look.
"Don't even think about it. These are for me. You'll have to find your own orcs."
"They're acting strangely," said Tungdil.
He quickly explained his hunch. "If you ask me, they're scouts. They must have been sent ahead to find a means of destroying the defences forever." It was all the encouragement Boindil needed.
"Hurrah! In that case, we'd better stop them."
He sprinted off, heading straight for the watchtower. Bounding up the stairs, he caught up with the orcs and killed 3 in quick succession. Only then did the rest of the troopers realize they were under attack. Muttering under his breath, Tungdil ran to the base of the tower and stopped. Dead orcs tumbled down the stairs, landing in a heap by the door. His help wasn't needed. By the time the rest of the dwarves caught up, 20 or so orcs had died by Ireheart's hand. The watchtower was too narrow and the orcs too broad-shouldered for close combat with a raging dwarf. At last, Boindil started to make his way down the staircase, stepping over the muddle of dead orcs, whose efforts had been hampered by their cumbersome swords, clubs, and axes.
"Quick! I want him alive,"
said Tungdil, pointing to the orc who had stopped to inspect the bolt. His chance of interrogating any of the troopers would be lost if Boindil got there first.
4 of you capture the beast. Everyone else come with me. We'll meet Boindil halfway."
They climbed the bloodied stairs, squeezing past bodies, taking care not to slip, and steering clear of falling corpses. Suddenly a clawed hand reached out and grabbed Tungdil by the ankle. Growling and snarling, the orc lunged toward him. But Tungdil struck out, burying his axe in the creature's right shoulder. With a pained grunt, the orc pulled on Tungdil's ankle, knocking him off his feet. Toppling backward, Tungdil landed in the arms of the dwarf behind him, and the orc, still attached to Keenfire, came too.
He should be dead by now, thought Tungdil, noticing the wounds inflicted by Boindil's axes.
Summoning his strength, he wrenched his axe from his antagonist's shoulder and kicked him in the kneecap to stop him getting up. Then, swinging Keenfire as savagely as the confines of the watchtower permitted, he took aim at his neck. The orc's head hit the wall and bounced down the stairs. The rest of him slumped to the floor and showed no sign of movement.
"Stubborn bastard," said the dwarf behind him, glowering at the corpse.
A terrible thought occurred to Tungdil.
"Shh,"
he commanded. Judging by the grunting and jangling at the bottom of the watchtower, Boindil's other victims were clambering to their feet.
"Everyone back," he ordered. "The beasts aren't dead."
His mind was gradually clearing. Only the perished land had the power to raise the dead, but its influence stopped at Gerdlegard's border, beyond the Northern Pass.
"It doesn't make sense."
His success in defeating the Revenant seemed to confirm that there was only one sure way to deal with the beasts.
"Chop off their heads!" he bellowed.
At the bottom of the watchtower, the dwarves at the rear of the unit were fighting off the sharp claws and hastily drawn daggers of a horde of undead beasts.
"They're Revenants!"
The battle started all over again, only this time it was fiercer and more dangerous. Tungdil fought his way out of the tower brandishing Keenfire. The axe lit up, vaunting its legendary power. Runes ablaze, the shimmering blades sliced through the air, leaving a trail of blinding light, but the spectacle seemed to bypass the orcs, who attacked with undiminished savagery. The beasts were natural fighters, quick to exploit the slightest mistake, and the dwarves, hampered by the height difference, were hard-pressed to behead them.
"Aim for their throats!"
yelled Tungdil, ducking and swinging his axe. He brought down his opponent with a blow to the leg and followed up with a decapitating strike. Panting heavily, he straightened up and looked around. The battle was shifting in favor of the orcs. All around him, dwarves were being killed or wounded after assuming, mistakenly as it happened, that they had dealt their antagonists a mortal blow. Most of Tungdil's companions, unfamiliar with revenants, were on the defensive, slashing pluckily but pointlessly at the orcs. Their axes cleaved through flesh and bone, but the undead orcs fought on regardless, faltering only if they lost both arms. The determination faded from the younger warriors' faces as the casualties grew.
"You need to behead them!"
shouted Tungdil, rushing to the aid of a dwarf who was hacking frantically at a clawed hand that was closing around his throat. Green blood spurted in all directions, but the orc, caring nothing for his injuries, merely tightened his grip. With three powerful strikes of Keenfire, Tungdil felled and killed the beast. The beasts had to be brought to their knees before they could be beheaded, which was troublesome and tiring, but the indefatigable Tungdil seemed to be everywhere at once. Inspired by his example, the dwarfs regained their confidence and overpowered the undead orcs. Victory didn't come cheap. Tungdil's unit had started with superior numbers, but 15 had fallen, and another 20 was seriously hurt. To everyone's relief, the slain dwarves showed no sign of rising from the dead to turn on their erstwhile friends.
"To the tower!"
shouted Tungdil to the survivors. He and the others raced up the steps, nearly colliding with Ironheart, who had cornered the final beast. The secondling swung both his axes simultaneously into the creature's groin. Yelping, the orc sank to his knees and dropped his sword, which clattered down the stairs past the warrior's boots.
"I need to behead him, right?"
he shouted. His axes sped forward, severing his antagonist's vile green head. He wiped his face, which was dripping with sweat, blood, and foul-smelling filth.
"Well, that was fun,"
he sighed happily,
bending down to clean his axes on the dead orc's jerkin.
By the hammer of Rakus, if only we could fight on narrow